when he would have the spirit to play, he would be on fire musically with the rhythm and with the changes, just in and out, fast and slow, hot and cool.
The playing invites you to come back some more. You know what I mean? When you hear Bud, you hear it and you go, hey, let me play that again. What? Yeah, there's so much to it.
He's considered one of the most influential pianists in jazz, whose virtuoso technique found careful balance with the flurry of emotions he so gracefully conveyed.
There's always a powerful emotional aspect to his music, and I think it's the kind of thing that it's impossible to listen to him without identifying, so that you never merely, you know, snap your fingers and pat your foot when Bud Powell is playing. It becomes a very profound experience, the way I think only the really great artists can do.
His emotion was deep. Some of it so deep, it was hurting. It hurts, especially if you hear Bud play certain ballads.
Nobody plays like him. I listen to it, I don't even know what he's playing. I don't know how he's hearing. Nobody knows what made him go from that note to that note. He was our guide.
Bud Powell has been a guide to generations of musicians. What's ironic is that he was such a wanderer in his own short life. In and out of psychiatric hospitals after a brutal beating from police when he was only 20, Powell led a very fractured existence. Yet this never seemed to conquer his creative spirit. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a tribute to the great bebop pianist and composer, the amazing Bud Powell. Bud Powell has become almost a mythical figure. Every musician who encountered him seems to have a Bud story. Barry Harris recalls one he heard from a fellow pianist.
See, Frank Hewitt told me a story how him and some cats went by Bud's house one morning. They said, come on, Bud, let's go out and have a ball, you know. Bud said, no, he was playing and practicing Embraceable You, you know. And so they went out and had a ball. He wouldn't go with them. Late that night, they came back, and they saw the light still on, so they went and knocked on the door, opened the door, and there was Bud Powell playing Embraceable You. That was a real Bud, you know, different kind of person.
A complex character, as his presence on the bandstand revealed. Watching him was perhaps one of the best windows into him. Pianist Chick Corea and Barry Harris.
Bud's presence just created a dual effect because he was obviously a troubled man and could not focus from one moment to the next. But then every time he started playing the piano, it was glorious. He would sit there and play so passionately and so great, and then he'd come to the end of a piece and just kind of sit there, and he'd put his hand in his pocket and stare.
You had to see it. The man never looked at the piano particularly. He looked up and he made little sounds, you know, and all this stuff would be coming out.
He almost looked like it sometimes, like he was at total peace with himself and with his audience.
Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean.
And other times he looked like he was challenging his audience and angry. He looked very angry sometimes playing. But he would always throw a handkerchief up on the piano because he perspired quite a bit
reach up and grab his handkerchief and wipe off the perspiration and drop it and get right back to the music without missing, just seemed like without missing a beat.
In 1964, pianist Bill Evans wrote about Bud, "When people talk about the bebop giants, Bird, Bud, Dizzy, and Miles, I think they underestimate Bud." Of those figures that Bill Evans cites, certainly Powell remains most obscure. Yet he was instrumental in furthering the language of bebop, and he set the standard for jazz piano thereafter. Writer Gary Giddens.
Bud's influence is incalculable. I mean, it's impossible to even think about where jazz piano would have gone without Bud Powell. A lot of influential pianists in that crucial period of the 1940s, but the basic style of jazz piano that we've all grown up with, whether it's Bill Evans or McCoy Tyner or Tommy Flanagan or Red Garland, you name it, they all come from Bud, because Bud showed them how to play the new music on the keyboard.
Bud drew crowds even when he wasn't in the clubs. Musicians used to drop by the Powell House, hoping to hear him practice. Drummer Roy Haynes.
We'd just knock on the door, and Bud would come to the door. When he would see me outside, he would say, "We don't want no geniuses in here," and close the door, slam the door, and then open the door back up and laughing like crazy from the bottom of his heart. He'd say, "Ah, you know I love you," and then we would go in, and he would just perform all his latest compositions in his bathroom. He was like this genius.
That word, genius, was applied to him often, even as a child. Earl Rudolph Powell was born September 27, 1924, in New York City. His parents, William and Pearl, both felt strongly about music and started Bud's training in classical music at age 5. Bud Powell biographer Peter Pullman.
By the age of 10, Powell, according to his father, was rented out, so to speak, for parties. People would come to William Powell and say, "You know, your son's just incredible. We heard him mimicking Tatum or doing a Waller impersonation on the piano. Can we use him? We're having a party down the street." So it was, you know, this kid in short pants going to late night parties to play. And I guess part of the appeal to the people at the party was it was just this kid, but he sounded like Art Tatum.
Powell considered Art Tatum to be his greatest influence and the only jazz pianist above his level technically. His other primary influence was Thelonious Monk, who 7 years Powell senior, became both a musical and personal mentor.
Monk was to Powell everything he wanted in a father figure, a confidant, a colleague. And Monk recognized Powell's talent, they say, instantly. That he saw the technique in Powell that perhaps he himself didn't have.
With Monk's encouragement, Bud began to navigate the Harlem club scene, and by 1941 had established quite a name for himself. 1942 brought an opportunity to reach beyond New York and tour with one of the most popular jump bands of the day, led by Duke Ellington's former trumpeter, Cootie Williams. Barry Harris remembers it.
Well, I tell people, if you want to hear some good Bud Powell, go get Cootie Williams' record. Turn on Clean Head Vincent, Is You Ain't My Baby. Clean Head Vincent sang in the song. But underneath him is some Bud Powell you never heard before in your life. The most beautiful Bud Powell. Clean Head say, Is You Ain't My Baby. Bud say, Bob, do you do you do do do. I say, oh my goodness.
The way you're acting lately makes me down. Is you, or is you ain't my baby? Maybe baby's found somebody new.
You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to pianist Bud Powell. I'm Nancy Wilson. In January 1945, after a Cootie Williams date in Philadelphia, Bud Powell met a twist of fate that would dramatically alter his life and career. Only 20 years old, he was brutally beaten by police, an event that would scar him for life. Peter Pullman.
The police said he was drunk and disorderly. That's passed on orally, we don't know. And they apprehended him. It's said that he resisted, and they beat him with sticks. Now, whether a musician of Powell's questionable strength and fortitude under such circumstances, a very shy and not physically confident man, would fight a number of policemen who had sticks, well, I leave it to you to decide whether that's true.
The Philadelphia police contacted Powell's mother, requesting that she come to get him in a car. They didn't feel he should leave their custody in his questionable state. Bud wasn't making sense.
And the legend has it that she was in the back seat with him. She had to cradle his head in her lap because his head hurt so much. He had such terrible headaches. And the car had to go very slowly because if it went over a bump, he would scream with pain.
When Powell's condition didn't improve, his mother took him to Harlem Hospital, where they administered tests. But doctors there couldn't figure out what was wrong or what to do with him. So they referred him to another hospital.
He didn't know what to do with him either. And in those days, if you couldn't immediately determine a cure or a potential cure, you sent him to a psychiatric hospital. That's just what you did because he got him out of your hair. I mean, in the report, the first report from Pilgrim of who he was, it said, he claims to be a musician, claims to play in a Broadway band. What do you mean a Broadway? What is a Broadway band? I mean, this kind of talk.
Powell remained in Pilgrim State Hospital for 2.5 months. This would be only the first of many institutionalizations over the next decade. Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean first met Bud Powell during this time.
You know, it's like meeting Beethoven or meeting any great genius. You never forget that. I met him when I was 15 after he had gotten this terrible beating. And so when I met him, he couldn't remember things in his life, and it was almost like being with a child.
Despite his mental instability, he could play piano. And well. McLean spent as much time as he could in the Powell home, listening to Bud practice, and sometimes even playing along on the saxophone. 7 years younger than Powell, McLean became almost a little brother to him, taking him around New York and keeping him from both drinking, which was a growing problem, and from wandering.
Sometimes he had a club date, a job to go to, and he would just say, is Jackie going to take me? You know, okay. And then I would show up and take him. He'd say, how do I look? You know, I said, oh, you look great, bud. Is my tie all right? You know, and he'd just look at how my sharp, Jackie. I said, yeah, bud. Because I was a kid, you know. I was in awe of him, you know. I was, like, so honored to be able to be with him and take him places. I was in love with his music and therefore in love with him.
During the second half of the 1940s, Bud Powell was busy in both his personal and professional life, despite his fragile mental state. He had a daughter, Celia, with his sweetheart, Mary Frances Funderburk, and he was at the absolute pinnacle of his playing. 1947 brought one of the greatest opportunities of his life when saxophonist Charlie Parker chose Bud to be his pianist on a now legendary recording session for Savoy. Miles Davis is on trumpet, Tommy Potter on bass, and Max Roach on drums. Donna Lee, recorded in 1947 with Charlie Parker on saxophone, Miles Davis on trumpet, Tommy Potter on bass, Max Roach on drums, and Bud Powell on piano. Powell earned enormous respect from his fellow musicians. Miles Davis, in his autobiography, refers to Bud as the greatest pianist in this era. Powell's relationship with Charlie Parker was a little more complicated. Jackie McLean.
You know, Bird, Charlie Parker, had a great respect for Bud because Bud was the only musician that I ever saw get on a stage with Charlie Parker and play up to that level. Everybody else that Charlie Parker stood on a stage with, he played above them. But the only person that I ever saw, besides Dizzy, stand on a stage with Charlie Parker and play as well as Charlie Parker and sometimes even better. I whisper that because no one would ever believe that. I've seen Bud play more than Charlie Parker, and he knew it.
By and large, he overcame his jealousy of Powell, and he was to some extent musically jealous of Powell.
Peter Pullman.
But he overcame that and recognized that Powell was a very special person, a very gifted artist, but a person who needed to be handled with kid gloves. There are many stories of Powell challenging Parker, needling Parker, trying to intimidate him musically on a bandstand. Sometimes Parker would descend to that level and battle it out with him. Jackie McLean tells stories of them literally, you know, just trading choruses on the bandstand for minutes on end while the rest of the band, like a street fight.
I saw them one night when they were playing chorus for chorus. I mean, they played a song and Charlie Parker went out and played his solo and Bud played his, and then Bird went back and took another couple of choruses, and then Bud wouldn't let him leave. He went and played some more, and then Bird played some more, and they kept doing that for a while until they took the song out. But it was a quiet war going on up there of music. Actually, it was really love. It was so great.
Round Midnight, recorded live at New York's Birdland. A historic Charlie Parker-Bud Powell exchange. Powell's career seemed to be taking on a momentum that was unstoppable. He was the pianist of choice for recording sessions with Dexter Gordon, Sonny Stitt, Sarah Vaughan, J.J. Johnson, and Fats Navarro, to name only a few. Yet, 6 months after that Charlie Parker studio session, he would once again find himself locked away from his musical livelihood, as you'll hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to pianist Bud Powell on NPR, National Public Radio. On November 15, 1947, just 6 months after Bud Powell's historic studio recording with Charlie Parker, he once again found himself in a local hospital. This time, he'd been hit on the head with a bottle in a bar fight. Naturally, his psychiatric history was dredged up, and once again, Powell was sent to a New York State facility, this time Creedmoor. He would remain there 11 months. Undergoing 40 treatments of electroconvulsive therapy, a new technique just being developed in the 1940s. Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean.
What Bud experienced in the hospital with shock treatments and what happened, only he could have spoken on. And he was so messed up when he came out that he never talked about that. So I never knew what he went through, only he knew that. Because I think that they gave him shock treatments and then sent him to the piano to see if he could still play. I think they experimented on Bud.
What's remarkable is that despite what Powell underwent, he could still play. Biographer Peter Pullman describes the institutionalizations as hiccups in his headlong ascent to stardom. Upon each hospital release, Powell essentially fled back to the piano to resume his career.
And between October of 48, when he's released, and January 9th, 49, he is a demon. He is playing every night, what I can document. He is playing in every combo. He is on 52nd Street. Everybody wants him. Bud, play in my group. Play here, play there. And it's his absolute peak.
In 1949, Powell undertook major recording projects for the Mercury, Roost, and Blue Note labels, The Blue Note session, one of the most notable, featured a quintet billed as Bud Powell's Modernists, with Fats Navarro on trumpet, a 19-year-old Sonny Rollins on saxophone, and Tommy Potter on bass. Roy Haynes was the drummer.
I can't even talk, you know, to hear this. Bouncing with Bud, yeah, I remember this very well. Oh boy, Sonny Rollins. That was a two-bar break I had on there. Wow. I can't even talk, you know, to hear this.
Bouncing with Bud, recorded in 1949 for Blue Note. Bud Powell on piano, Fats Navarro on trumpet, Sonny Rollins on tenor saxophone, Tommy Potter on bass, and Roy Haynes on drums. These studio sessions not only put Bud on the map as a leader, but also as a composer. And the names of some of his pieces are pretty revealing. Hallucinations, Oblivion, Wail, Un Poco Loco. Powell was a prolific and unusual composer whose music rings with echoes of the classical composers he studied as a child, Chopin, Liszt, and Bach. This is Powell's own Bud on Bach. Is Un Poco Loco. This is Dance of the Infidels. This is Dusky and Sandy. Jackie McLean.
His music is exciting. It has the essence of great heroes from childhood. Zorro on the back of his horse with the horse reared up in the air, Zorro's face and mask, or either D'Artagnan with the knee boots and a big feather in his hat like one of the Three Musketeers. But that's the kind of excitement and adventure he had in a lot of his music. You know, bam! That's Bud Powell, full of adventure and romance and beauty.
In 1951, Bud Powell once again found himself in a local hospital, this time after being arrested with Thelonious Monk for heroin possession. The charges against Powell were dropped, but he was again sent to a psychiatric hospital, where he would remain for a year and a half. His longest stay. Peter Pullman.
I consider the August 51 arrest of Powell and Monk to be a watershed in bebop history and jazz history because of Monk being denied a chance to play in clubs for years and for the fact that it led to Powell's longest hospitalization, and upon his release, he is still a great, great artist, but he has lost something. And people on the street notice it. People at Birdland recognize that he is not the same player. Musicians are whispering about it. They still have a lot of affection for him. They still support what he's doing, but it's clear that his playing is starting to decline.
Even after his release from Creedmoor State Hospital in 1953, Powell's actions continued to be monitored. While working at New York's legendary club Birdland, he was kept under a watchful eye. Often, it was by a woman named Altivia Edwards, or Buttercup, who purported to be his wife. It was under such circumstances that pianist Barry Harris first met Powell.
You won't believe this. It was at the Elvin Hotel on 52nd, right across from Birdland. I was staying there, and he was staying there. And he came and knocked on my door and said, "You got any shoes I can put on?" I said, "Well, I got some shoes." So he came in, and he put on my shoes, and he left. Buttercup, his wife, came and cursed me out because she had hid his shoes and things to make him stay in, you see. But then I say, "Well, how do I refuse shoes to Bud Powell?" You know?
He was a victim, a prisoner.
Jackie McLean.
They used to keep him locked up in the Alvin Hotel across the street from the club. They used to get a room for him over there, and they used to have somebody with him all the time because he always had to have a chaperone. You couldn't leave Bud in a room and go and leave him there. You either had to lock him in there or either have somebody in there with him because he would open the door and wander into the street, you know. He was in a state of grace, and you can look up and Bud would be walking down the street.
Thank you. You're listening to NPR Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Bud Powell. I'm Nancy Wilson. The 1950s saw some of Bud Powell's most erratic playing. He had his on nights when he was as great as ever, but he also had off nights when he just couldn't seem to get the notes out. In 1959, at the urging of Buttercup, Powell undertook a very big move in his life, away from New York, where he'd always lived, to Paris. Buttercup thought he'd find a better reception from the public there, and the French were very adoring. But over the 5 years he stayed in France, his life, his existence, was far from happy. Jackie McLean encountered him in 1961.
I walked into a club, and he was on the stage playing. And he hadn't seen me in many, many years. And he just happened to look from the piano out into the crowd and saw my face. He stopped playing, got up, walked off the stage. The band was still playing. Walked over to me and said, "Jackie, is that you?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Are you going to stay and wait for me, take me home?" I said, "Yeah, I'll wait for you, bud." I said, "Go on back on the stage, man. Go ahead back and finish the song." And he just stood looking at me. He said, "Jackie." It was sad. And I took him and let him get a drink. I couldn't help it, you know. I took him to a bar, let him drink. We both got drunk. I got drunk, and he was just, well, we were staggering all over the street till I took him back to the hotel. He was very sad during those years because he was like a prisoner.
Bud Powell in Paris, playing My Old Flame. In 1963, a devoted French fan named Francis Podras, along with tenor saxophonist Johnny Griffin, pried Powell away from Buttercup. Very sick with tuberculosis, he was put in a French sanitarium where he recovered over the course of 6 months. During Powell's convalescence, he started to write music again, as he described to a French journalist in one of the few interviews that exists of Bud Powell. The interviewer asks him about a new composition.
"Voulez-vous nous en donner le titre et le fredonner?"
"I wrote In the Mood for a Classic."
"Bud, pour qui avez-vous composé ce morceau, s'il vous plaît?"
"I composed it for France in general." "Bobby,
Bud Powell in 1964 with In the Mood for a Classic. Upon Powell's release from the hospital, Francis Podras began to organize gigs for him, including a series in New York at Bud's old haunt, Birdland. Powell returned to Manhattan after having been away for 5 years. Peter Pullman.
He's met by the press at the airport, and there were more articles written in August of 1964 when Powell returned to New York than had been written about him in the American media, American press, in all the years previous, including Time, Newsweek, The New Yorker, and the Daily Papers. He comes back and he opens at Birdland to a hero's welcome with his daughter, Celia, and his first girlfriend and only love of his life, Mary Frances Von der Berg, in the audience to a standing ovation, and he plays brilliantly. And the press starts to talk Bud's back. God, it's great. Of course, in retrospect, we say, well, where was the press all those years? Where were all those fans when they ignored him throughout the 50s? Now that, you know, hail the conquering hero.
Unfortunately, Powell's playing took a turn for the worse, and the 6-week engagement at Birdland was cut short. After that, Bud Powell essentially disappeared. He didn't show up at the airport when he and Podras were due to fly back to France, and instead chose to stay in New York, where he no longer had anyone who could keep him from drinking. Powell quickly lapsed back into his alcohol dependency, which was the one force that was most destructive to his playing. After the Birdland engagement, Bud Powell gave only 2 more public concerts in his life, the last one on May 1st, 1965.
And from May 1st of 1965 until July 31st, 1966, it's the slow, agonizing death of an alcoholic. There's no other way to say it. Nobody could stop him from drinking. Nobody could rouse him. It was just a matter of time. And July 31st, 1966, he died in cirrhosis of the liver, Brooklyn Hospital.
I had just left the hospital. He died about 45 minutes after I left his bedside.
Jackie McLean.
And he was with the woman that I met him with, his original Mae Frances. And I kind of stood by. I stayed at the whole hospital several hours, just, you know, talking to Mae Frances and then going sitting by the bed and then going out and sitting and talking with her. And finally, when I went home, I wasn't home, but a few minutes, the phone rang, and Mae Frances said, Jackie, Bud is gone. I said, oh, boy.
Bud Powell died July 31st, 1966, at age 41. And though, in a sense, he'd been slipping away for over a dozen years, his passing signified an enormous loss to the music world. Roy Haynes.
If he lived longer and he played more often and he was treated better and had better jobs and made more money and the whole thing, you know, well, there's no telling what he would have developed into.
Bud Powell's body of recordings stands as testament to his immeasurable contribution, but at the same time, they do reveal his inconsistency as a performer. Despite some obvious reasons for this, it has led some to question whether Powell took too many artistic risks. Writer Gary Giddens not only disagrees, but feels that's precisely the excitement of Powell.
Bud sometimes plays very badly. I mean, he plays as badly as any great figure has ever played on records. But he never coasts. He's either great or he's terrible. There's this tremendous honesty about his music. And when he's really in the throes of the muse, it seems to me that he is willing to go beyond what he knows he can do. There is a nanosecond between what goes on in his brain and what comes out of his fingers. And that's the excitement of Bud Powell, that what he thinks of, he will try. And sometimes what he thinks is not predicated on what he knows he can do or what he has already done.
One of the great artists of the 20th century who influenced generations of musicians.
Pianist Chick Corea.
And right away you say, okay, these were the violations of the man, and say, okay, that's the background. And now here's Bud, the artist who transcended all of those barriers, all of the adversity. And how did he come to be one of the most revered musicians of the 20th century? Through all of that, there's the beauty of it.
He was an extraordinary person.
Roy Haynes.
Musically and otherwise. Your life is built up of hots and colds, you know. If you're playing the truth, it's going to come out in your music.
Jackie McLean.
It's Bud Powell. Powerful and incredibly engaging. Great genius.
Our tribute to Bud Powell was written and produced by Molly Murphy, post-production engineer Andy Rosenberg. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith. Our website coordinator is Patrick Breslin. Special thanks to Kareel Wheeler and NPR's New York Bureau for recording assistance, to Sean Campanucci for research assistance, to the John Addison Concert Hall in Maryland, to Vincent Pelote at the Institute for Jazz Studies at Rutgers, and to Peter Pullman, whose upcoming biography, Whale, The Life of Bud Powell, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.